show done in 3 hours, or as Martin Scorsese calls it, Act One.
Get it going. Hey, hey, hey. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. We're Matt and Bob. We're here to pod once again. We're going to be talking about Killers of the Flower Moon. We're Matt and Bob. We're here to pod. You're listening to the
analysis.
That's right, Bobby. We are talking about the number one smash hit of the box office.
Huge smash hit.
That's right. Eras Tour by Taylor Swift.
It's me. Hi. I'm the problem, it's me. I did see that last Thursday, by the way.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
I was amazed when I found out that it's a 3 hour plus concert film about three nights in Los Angeles. Not the whole tour, not a behind the scenes documentary. Just a fastball of what you missed.
Were living in the concert. And you know what? I had a great time. I'm not even kidding. It's not hyperbole. I have Taylor Swift, and I know we talked last week about media and branding and all of that wrapping up into sports when we talked about the David Beckham documentary. And I know that Taylor Swift is a big example of that right now with just her affiliation with the NFL, and a lot of people are having Taylor fatigue. But I really have always kind of liked her music. My fiance is a Swiftie and is a massive fan, but she's always playing in the house, and I don't know, I like the jams, I like some of the more nuanced albums, I listen to it all the time now, and I actually did enjoy watching, we all the time, anytime we're doing chores, Taylor Swift, some form of Taylor Swift is on, but I really enjoyed the Eras Tour. I know we're not here to talk about the Eras Tour, but I had a good time on it.
Well, like most things, you have good intentions of having a normal conversation about something meaningful, and it becomes about Taylor Swift.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm curious to see it just because I want to see what a $15,000 ticket would have gotten you as opposed to like a $16 ticket to a movie.
I'm very of the mindset that there is no concert on the planet that's worth more than $250. Like, that's where I'm at. So, I have tickets to see her in October of next year in Miami, and our tickets were like $180. I mean, we're in the nosebleeds, but that's where I'm living.
The good thing about Taylor Swift, not to keep going on this, but apparently she, you know, she's there for all fans. You know, it's like you go to SoFi, and as an artist, you have to rent out all their different LED screens, and she had them all bought out. Now I learned that they were filming a movie, so that helps explain why. You know, you go see, Destiny's Child.
Beyonce.
Yeah, so Beyonce played at SoFi, and she had like one of these screens available, and everyone's like, "What the fuck? I can't see anything." And then Taylor Swift, it's like everybody, no matter what seat you're sitting in, you get a good show. So I do respect that.
I also I think she's a great artist, a great storyteller, a la Bruce Springsteen, another great songwriter and storyteller. But anyway, we're here to talk about a different story.
Killers of the Flower Moon debuted at a modest $30 million opening weekend. As I mentioned, it was not destroyed by Taylor's second weekend, but that movie has already done a couple hundred million. Tough beat, though, right? I mean, you got a first theatrical Scorsese release, I think, since Wolf of Wall Street. Because you had Irishman went straight to Netflix. Where do you stand on Scorsese? Is he good?
Yeah, I'm good with Scorsese. Real quick, I wanted to add this joke in before we got into Taylor Swift talk, but I was surprised to find out that Matt Hayes has the same taste in women as Ernest Burkhart. I like them squishy. I like them. They could be big. They could be small. They could be
blue.
I don't care what the color. Blue. They could be blue. For all. I'm like, this is me having a conversation with Matt Hayes.
Yeah, all the time.
Just big, with my, little. I don't fuck anything.
Just showing up with my overbite.
Yeah.
Pee Wee's Playhouse haircut. Yeah. How do you feel? So your boy Leonard.
Leonard DeCap.
Leonard DeCap.
My favorite actor.
He shows up straight up an evil, dim-witted guy with a not very attractive haircut. He's supposed to be playing a teenager just come back from the war. He's in his mid-40s.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we had a kind of a pre-sale bet going here where you're all in on Cillian Murphy, you're locked in on him winning the Oscar. I was like, well, hold on a second, I want to see what Leonard does in Killers. How's your confidence pool?
My confidence is very high right now.
Okay.
Let me start with this. I'm critical of this movie. I was underwhelmed and slightly disappointed by this movie.
Okay.
I also want to say that I believe, and I'm not trying to be too fart smelly here or too big of a theater or a movie theater turd, but like, it's a privilege to see a Martin Scorsese movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a privilege to go to the theater and have these types of dramas still exist. Like, I know they're very few and far between. I have always, like most movie nerds out there, like love and respect. He's a must-see to me. I think he is the master of his craft, and he's my favorite director. Tarantino is, me and you probably have more fun with the Tarantino movies, but I just so very much appreciate the way that Martin Scorsese is a master of his craft. With that said, this is when he claims or labels things as deeply personal. That would be the Silence movie.
God, I hated Silence. Or
this was another one where he's like, this is a deeply personal movie. This is a movie I've been trying to make. And, you know, he's reaching the end of his life. I think he's making some of these movies that he's kind of earned the ability to make. But anytime he says deeply personal now, I'm going in a little guarded because I found this very sloggy. I was kind of surprised because me and you had both read the book.
Love the book.
That the book is told from the perspective of the FBI, mm-hmm. and it's told from the perspective of Tom, the Jesse Plemons, a.k.a. fake Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's told from his perspective, and so at the end you kind of get the reveal of, oh my God, here are your bad guys. And they flipped it, and they turned it on its head, and they decided to tell the perspective from the Osage and from the couple within, and Leo even switched. He was supposed to play Tom, and then he switched, and now he's playing Ernest. And they changed it narratively, and I really think that it took away a lot of the suspense and some of the intrigue of the movie. And I just felt that I hate talking about length. I really don't think length is a criticism of a movie. I think you can talk about pace and you can talk about impact and engagement in the movie besides just because Wolf of Wall Street is really long. And
most
Scorsese watch,
movies
and,
are
yeah.
plus 3 hours.
And I have a whole list here of this is his longest that's not a documentary. But I have a whole list here of the lengths of his movies. And they're all very long, but some of them, Goodfellas, you can sit... Even at a bar with the sound off, it just enwraps you, or Wolf of Wall Street, and you know, there's a big difference between a Coke sex binge with McConaughey coming in with amazing dialogue and I'm not fucking leaving, and all of that. Like, that's a very different than giving someone insulin slowly. So you know, it was like there was a lot here. There was it took a lot of its time, and I really didn't feel like it was necessarily earned. But there's also amazing things happening. Like, cinematically, there's some really beautiful shots. I'm thinking about when the farm is going up and they've got the silhouette, or you've got the oil bursting, and you know, you've got the warriors kind of like dancing in the oil. There's a lot of these kind of really beautiful cinematic moments that you want to see on the screen, but that's a tough fucking hang in a movie theater for 4 hours, dude. So yeah. Anyway, I had a lot of mixed feelings about it, and I did not enjoy the ride.
I went back and forth. I was actually surprised when I got out of the movie theater and it was like, what, 4 hours later, go in at 2:30, half hour of previews out there around 6:30. I was like, I wouldn't have guessed it was his longest. Like, if I didn't know the runtime, and I was just like, I don't know, I feel like the epics of Casino, Goodfellas, Irishman, you feel like you witness multiple people, a group of people's entire lives Whereas this one, I feel like there's it's less obvious the passage of time. Obviously, we get some kids coming in there, but the characters aren't aged up as they usually are. You don't see like the beginning, middle, and end. We kind of just dive right in. I'm with you on the fact that there were moments, specifically kind of the final third, where we're in the jail cell, and there's some good monologues back and forth between De Niro and Leo. But
don't forget about Brendan Fraser.
That totally this guy
is an Oscar? God!
That totally took me out. But at that point, I'm like, okay, let's get some Schadenfreude going. I want to see these people brought to justice. I've been living with them for too long now. But that's just me. This is a nonfiction story. So, like, that's kind of me as, like, maybe a impatient moviegoer where I want to see people brought to justice, even though we know that they really got away with it and, like, everyone's complicit. Now, getting into your critique. Sorry, the book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. So that came out in 2017. I think me and you both took down the audiobook, but I certainly did. And really enjoyed it. I love this guy, David Gran. Before this, he wrote Lost City of Zed. He's got a new book out called The Wager, kind of about a shipwreck, mutiny sort of thing. Really interesting style of writing. It's nonfiction, but it's done with like a narrative twist. The birth of the FBI, this Osage Murders, like
J. Edgar Hoover, never heard of him.
Like you said, I mean, how cool would it have been to get a Scorsese kind of whodunit, Tarantino-esque, Leo is this FBI guy. But then you think about, you know, he goes to Osage County, he's meeting with the Osage, and he's talking to everybody, and they're like, the heart of this story is the fact that
they loved each other.
They loved each other. And he's like, that's way more interesting and harder to tell. Now, he could have gone in there like white savior, you know, sort of thing, where Leo comes in, he solves the murders, blah, blah, blah. It's a twist at the end. We find out who, you know, it's, oh my God, De Niro, he was the guy. And that would have been badass, but I guess, obviously, done before. And plus it's like, that's what you get from the book. And then, so not only did that kind of change his mind in terms of crafting a narrative, but then, you know, he casts Leo, and Leo comes back. It's like, okay. But like, what's the heart of the story? It's Molly. It's
Molly and Ernest. Yeah.
Ernest. He's like, I want to play Ernest. And he's like, well, shit. So then they have to recraft it. They restructure it. And then we know who the bad guys are from the jump, which is not, I mean, you know, Goodfellas. We're living with these gangsters the whole time. It's not necessarily an impediment.
I would say, though, the unravel isn't intense enough. Like, I'm thinking about the moment of Hale grabbing Ernest's ears and the calm down, like the men talking in rooms and them doing the interrogation scenes, and then here's another door open and another guy, you know, Blackie walks through, or now Ernest is gonna walk in on this guy, and it's just the downfall, you know. And you think about these Scorsese movies where he deals with a lot of the same, you know, like broken men, broken characters, people doing evil deeds, getting their comeuppance, things like that. But it's like, if you think about Goodfellas, and you think about like the when it turns and it goes down, how like riveting that is. Or you think about Wolf of Wall Street, and like when everything starts falling apart for Belfort, like it's like those are just like really engaging and captivating moments. Like this, I guess, like you've got like Leo wailing on the floor because his daughter's died, and you've got kind of it was a lot more subdued, which I can respect, right? But it doesn't mean it doesn't mean that it makes for an enjoyable experience.
Well, yeah, like
especially if you've been in there for 3 hours watching all sorts of little like room people talking in rooms. Oh, you got to leave the funeral because of this, you know, this politicking that we're doing right now with, you know, who's got what inheritance going, and all these different little moments of trying to convince people to do his bidding. And I mean, there's just a lot that's baked in there. So by the time you get there, and I don't even get kind of an energetic climax, I just felt like I was...
I guess the point is that, all right, so in, you know, Jordan Belfort, he's kind of escaping. He's just... It's like a Catch Me If You Can. He's just on the edge of getting caught the entire movie, right? It's also Casino, Leo. Irishman. Like, there are people coming after these bad guys, and we kind of... We're on their side, and in a way, we want them to get away with it because it's more fun to see these. But with this...
The anti-hero, yeah.
With this, it's like... there's hundreds of people murdered and no one gave a shit.
Yeah. It's like, well, that's the point.
No one is coming after them. That's why there's like there's less of like a downfall, because it's like, all right, I guess we gotta go see about these Osage murders. But
it is similar in Wolf of Wall Street, and that part of the theme of that is that, you know, this kind of white collar crime, the crime still pays, because he ends up getting a book and a movie made about him, and he ends up basically pretty much unscathed besides the fact that his wife had left him. And in this one, the De Niro speech at the end where he's like, this isn't going to make a difference. Like, the people will forget. They'll move on. I'll be able to move back to Oklahoma, and I'm going to walk back into my old life. Yeah. And Leo's like, no, that's not going to happen. And I did like at the end, instead of just doing title card placards, they did this kind of radio play.
I was so shocked by that. I almost actually forgot about it, but until you just brought it up. But yeah, Jack White as like a radio play, like, where
that I thought it was cool. I thought it was creative, instead of being like, this is what happened to De Niro.
Absolutely. I was like, oh, this is like an animated version of placard cards. And then, okay,
so yeah, they did it. They kind of, that's your kind of epilogue or whatever. But with that said, like, they go back, like, neither one of them, like, finishes their life in jail. They did all these murders. They, like, were caught red-handed concocting all this. And De Niro, Bill Hale, ends up getting out of jail. He was banned from Oklahoma, but still ends up going back all the time. And, like, he's right. And that's part of, like, what Scorsese's trying to say. And that's why he steps out there and he's like, no one's mentioning these murders. Scorsese gives the final piece before we go into the crane shot of the Osage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's really talking about how, you know, these things are a part of our human nature, these clashes against, you know, philosophy and culture, but they're kind of ingrained in American history. And in these horrors, there's so many of these horrors. It's not just the ones that you're taught about in the book, in the history book, you know. And so I see the themes there, and I know he wants us to live. And really, it's supposed to be every time he sticks her with that insulin, every time they're doing another one of these plots against the Osage, that's supposed to be sickening to you. That's supposed to be the energy of the movie, and it works in some ways and it doesn't in others.
I think I'm excited to see this again, because
so you're gonna rewatch it? I don't know if I'll ever rewatch
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no,
in I, full. I think, don't know, man.
I think this could be a masterpiece.
Really?
That I think
that was my question, is what's your rewatchability on this? And mine's very low.
I definitely want to rewatch it, because we already talked about cinematography. I think you could see this as, it could be like an Irishman situation, a lot of nominees, maybe not a lot of wins, but forget about Oscars, but I think it could be celebrated for its production design, its cinematography and costuming, soundtrack. The soundtrack,
a lot of the technical elements.
I was just listening to the soundtrack before we got on, and it's this bum bum bum. I mean, it's kind of like this pending doom sort of thing. This like drum beat of like the slow build of like this omnipresent evil that's also stupid. All the villains are idiots in this movie. They're just like moonshiners, basically, that are like, oh, this person has money.
They're bums. They even talk about it in the tribal huddle, where they're like, these men are just idiot bums. they're not even like slick con artists.
No, and then the one guy, it's like, if I adopt these children and they're killed, do I get their inheritance? Are you saying that you're going to adopt and murder these children? Well, not if it's not,
not, if it's not illegal.
Yeah.
Which, well, I mean, if I'm not going to get the money, then we'll not. No. Like, they were so blatantly...
According to Scorsese, that's like word for word pulled from testimony. So that's that's actually. So this is the people we're dealing with. But I think my initial shock at the narrative structure, where it's like, oh, we're just gonna dive right in, and we know who's done this the entire movie.
Yeah.
I think because once you've read the book, and it is like a celebration of the FBI, like how great we are. We solved this first thing, J. Edgar Hoover, blah blah blah. But then when you get in deep with like the dark water, it's a little messier and like. It's super complicated. Like the fact that like this guy was murdering her daughter or her sisters and family, and poisoning her, but there was love there, you know, and she sits in the trial, you know, and she gives him that opportunity to come clean about what his partner was.
That was my favorite scene. That was my favorite scene is what was in the, and he, you think maybe if he's just outright and he's like, yep, I was doing the wrong thing and I'm so sorry and I love you. And he does the lie on the insulin and she gets up and moves out of the room.
What's great is that he's so dumb that it's not until he tries some of this poison and it's like knocked on his ass in the seat.
Yeah.
It's like, oh shit, I've been killing this woman. Because the entire time Hale is like, we just need to slow her down. Just need to slow her down. She just needs to rest, you know, all this. And like he goes along with it. Like I can't remember the last time I saw Leo play such a doofus.
A dullard, yeah. And he really goes, he's doing a few things acting wise. So I got very like Sling Blade vibes from him.
Oh yeah.
Especially with the jowl and like the turned up, like it was like he's like, oh, this is my southern bumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
He also does this thing, he's done it in a few different movies where he goes like back of the voice, like back of the throat. It's like very
revenant.
back of the throat. I get more like he did it a little bit for Aviator when he was putting on an accent. And Leo can do accents. Like he's done it in Blood Diamond with a South African accent. He's done it in different
That's
ways. But
good.
It also reminded me of when he was doing like almost his 1920s Gatsby. He kind of like good old sport. He gets like in the back. I'm not doing it good enough, but he like goes back of the throat. But there was also some times where, and Brecken actually brought this up, but she was like, sometimes he would slip into, because, you know, his comfort zone is this, like, cocky, almost like a Jordan Belfort. Like, that's, a lot of times he kind of, you know, he's this, like, has a level of arrogance and a level of slyness. And, like, every now and again, I kind of got those vibes, too. And obviously it's a conscious choice where the character is trying to mask himself or you know be a wolf in sheep's clothing and things like that, but I was oddly thrown off by the character when Tom White comes to the door for the first time and he's like come back Friday, and he was like this whole like my wife's sick you see type of a deal, and it felt like a different character than a lot of the character I was watching through most of the movie that was had the kind of Godfather jowls like bulldog look.
Mm-hmm.
Like he looked different altogether. So I guess that might
well because he's finally like maybe scared about like the first time that he might be getting in trouble or he might be doing something wrong or
or maybe it's like him sober because like when he's wasted he kind of becomes more animalistic. I don't know, but anyway, sometimes it felt like I was watching a different character. As much to say.
Yeah, I mean the fact that this is you know you got the Scorsese legends of De Niro and DiCaprio sharing a screen together for the first time. I mean, I think the
they were in they were in This Boy's Life, but De Niro or Scorsese didn't direct that.
Yeah,
and Leo was like a kid; he was a teenager.
But it's you know it's early era Scorsese and new era Scorsese bringing his two muses together, which was kind of a thrill. And I thought De Niro's been phoning it in for a long time.
Like, he was awesome.
Oh, absolutely incredible. I mean, like, you know, this is not The Intern or whatever. I think he's like, oh, I'm in a Scorsese movie. I got to show up. But I think Lily Gladstone was probably the best acting performance in the movie.
She was phenomenal. And she's the emotional core of it. And if you don't care about her, if you don't care about her rotting in that bed, then it's a really long hang. And I definitely did. Every time her sisters went down. I like that they had kind of smaller moments with her and her sisters, so you got connected to those characters. And so when they did pass, she and it just when you when they they did pass, you felt the pain. I like that they showed her in smaller moments with her mother. I thought that all of that was earned. I thought her track was really well earned.
I think the first half is better than the second half, just because we kind of, you know, she gets put on the bench.
Yeah.
She gets put on the bench a little bit, right? Where, you know, literally is just stuck in bed. And it's tough. You know, you got to be sick and portray all these delirium and hopefulness and scared, like all these emotions.
Yeah. It is heartbreaking when they're hauling her out. The FBI agents like find her in the mm-hmm. bed, and she's like at death's door, and she's seen the owl. And I thought that was actually pretty well done by
the owl stuff. Yeah.
When the owl swoops in, like there was an audible gasp in our theater, like, oh shit, she's going to die. So he crafted that really well. But when they're hauling her out and she's still like, where's my husband? Where's that trust that he had built with her? And it really really breaks your heart. And that was the point of that space there.
Yeah, she's really kind of the anchor of the movie. And I thought she just had such a calmness. Like, she's sharing a screen with like the biggest movie stars to ever live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's been in a couple like indie films. But I think her assuredness, like confidence in the role. Their date was really cool, where like he picks her up, and I guess this is an improv where it's like, I don't know what that means, but it must be Indian for handsome devil.
Yeah, I'm kind of finding that it must be handsome devil.
Yeah, there you go. You're finding it. And then that was, and then her laugh was genuine, according to Scorsese. And then when they're sitting there and she's like, don't say anything, just listen to the storm. That scene was cool. I was like super impressed, and I think that locked me in, but then it does drag, and you kind of mm-hmm. feel it. But I'll take long Corsese over a 80-minute shitty film.
Absolutely. That's why I said it. I guess that's why I said it at the top. It's like, I'm still happy that I get to see this. I'm critical of it, and I didn't think it was the best hang. I also put this movie, it was my most anticipated movie of the year, so I'm a little bit let down by it. But I saw the Bill Hale character was awesome. Definitely that con artist, you know, just sitting in there in those tribal conversations, him being everyone's best friend, but also just all the just inherent racism, and just the way he was like, I'm not going to be able to systematically take their money, so I'm going to come in the back door, and, mm-hmm. and all the evil that goes behind that. And I also just loved him, you know, call me king, and it very much reminded me of that Foxcatcher with Steve Carell, and he was like, call me Golden Eagle.
Right.
He's like, call me Eagle, or like the way some of these men, they get their little towers, their thrones, you know, and they really do believe that they are the king of their little universe. And it just, I thought he was so good in his manipulation of Ernest, and the way he's able to make his suggestions and everything. It was really, really interesting.
I'm trying to remember his character, or the real life character as described and displayed in the book, there was way more of a turn, right? Because it's like, oh, there's like this super rich guy who's a cattle farmer. He's not mm-hmm. interested in the head rights or the Osage. He makes his money with cattle.
Yes.
And it's like, how could he possibly be involved? He has all this money. And they allude to that in the movie, where it's like, well, his uncle has money. He doesn't even need it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember in the book where did you find out that he's orchestrating the murder of these families to actually have the oil money come back to him somehow? Because
that's why he's so pissed that Leo starts having kids.
Yeah.
Because he's like, oh, here's another line of inheritance that I mm-hmm. need to get rid of. He's like, and that's he's you have sex with her in her sickened state? And Leo's like, yeah, it's my wife, like that's what happens, dude.
Right.
But you could see the anger. He's like, fuck, now I gotta take out Leo's kids. And there's just him trying to get him to sign away that he's like, we gotta keep this money in the family in case something happens to you, aka I'm 100% gonna murder you.
Why can't he just, I mean, yeah, all right, so he's on this cattle ranch that doesn't have any oil under it, but why can't he just, you know, have a straw that goes all the way to their milkshake.
Yeah, honestly, there is a little bit of that, though. There's a little bit definitely. Of that, I've got a competition and I don't want to see anyone else succeed. It's like, he's got the money. It's not that he needs money, necessarily. I think he
doesn't want to see Osage with money.
Yeah, and there's you've got that whole room full of people. You know, have you? Can you see the wolf in this picture? That Leo read in the book, and it's like that's the wolves. You've got basically you've got the clan that's in there. You've got the sheriff. You've got the
masons.
Doctors and the masons, and they're all in there. And
society of wife fuckers.
Society of wife fuckers. They were in the way back. Greg Ott in the red robes, but I think that goes back to Scorsese's point of the inherent racism and in the different ways that people are able to be out-leveraged when they have control over government systems and everything else, right?
Yeah, I mean, on paper and thematically, it's a knockout. I think Scorsese tackling these, everything he's trying to say, the heart of the movie, that's all gravy, right? But then I think it's just you go in there and you're like, I want to see like a Catch Me If You Can Scorsese film. And I've read the book. I know what goes on. I know this is going to be titillating. And then it's your kind of expectations are flipped. And then you're kind of in for a little bit of a slog. I don't know. It's tough. I think that's why it's worthy of a rewatch, just because now those expectations are out there and you kind of know the players and some of that, the exposition of Blackie and what his thing and the Red Roadster and how that plays in and blah, 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 blah. And who's serving jail time for who.
That history stuff, if you're into that, I guess it's good and it inspires you to go do more research. I'm more on a line of I'm interested in more of the character and the narrative. So it's almost like when they're doing the slow zoom of Leo and Wolf of Wall Street and he starts to explain the con and he's like, you know what? Do you really care? What's important is it's absolutely fucking illegal. Let's get back to the character stuff.
Yeah.
Like, okay. And then we cut and it's like, I don't give a fuck about like some of these nuanced characters or how accurate it was in a testimony or a transcript. Like I want compelling narrative. And
what's interesting about this project is that because right around the time they signed up for it, they were trying to get Devil in the White City off the ground, which is in some ways a similar story. It has nothing to do with indigenous peoples or anything, but it has to do with a guy systematically murdering people. You know, while a town is built up from the ground up, and they couldn't get that off the ground, maybe because there wasn't the heart of the story that they were looking for with this. I'm curious about that. But I mean, I just the Rotten Tomatoes here, I'm usually solid. Like the consensus, enormous in runtime, theme, and achievement. Killers of the Flower Moon is a sobering appraisal of America's relationship with indigenous peoples and yet another artistic zenith for Scorsese and his collaborators. Yeah. I think that's all pretty accurate.
I think of myself as a movie turd. Sometimes I can get a little snobby, and I sat there and pounded the table and defended the Irishman runtime and everything, but I didn't feel it in this one. I have a quick list here, but The Irishman was 209 minutes long, but it doesn't count for his theatrical releases because it went straight to stream. There's two other ones that he had. They were both documentaries, the No Direction Home by Bob Dylan and the George Harrison documentary. But again, those are documentaries. This is 206 minutes long, so this is his longest one. Other than that, it's 26 minutes longer than Wolf of Wall Street. Wolf of Wall Street's 180 minutes long.
Say that again?
It's 26 minutes longer than Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah,
because that's 180. 179 minutes is Casino, and then Aviator is 170 minutes, and then 168 minutes of Gangs in New York, and then it kind of flows from there. So yeah. I think it's very long-winded, and like I said, it's I don't think it's time always well spent. I think he could have. I think it's okay to say this is an intimate character drama that could have been 45 minutes shorter. And I think that's fair. And it doesn't mean that I don't understand or appreciate the artistic value that's happening.
Yeah, I think you could maybe make some edits later on in the film, kind of cut out a little bit of the procedural drama. But yeah, I guess like the weight and gravity and the length of time these crimes were committed and the systematic expunging of a family, yeah. I think that takes time to tell. Now, I didn't actually but know there's no the runtime going in. What's that?
Yeah. Well, there's no fun. Some of those other movies that are longer, like you yeah, kind of yeah. have some fun on the way up. Not a lot of fun happening here, which is okay. But it's a lot when you're in that emotional space for that long.
You know, yeah, it would have been great if he had squeezed in McConaughey as like a traveling snake oil salesman. Yeah,
or just more Fraser, more Brendan Fraser, just to be like
much more Brendan Fraser.
This is ridiculous. He was beating you, right? Okay, thank you. Totally different movie than John Lithgow. Yeah. Just what? Anyway, needless to say, we didn't like.
I gotta
Brendan
think
Fraser.
That was played for laughs.
It was played for pain for me, but anyway, I digress.
Yeah. Three hours, 26 minutes. Yeah, go ahead.
I was talking to someone was asking me at work. You know, what'd you do this weekend? Saw this movie. What'd you think? I was a little disappointed. I read the book. They changed the narrative. We kind of know who's the killers are right away. Mm-hmm. They changed the perspective of the storytelling. And yeah. she was like, you know what that reminds me of? Gossip Girl. The new Gossip Girl. You know who the Gossip Girl is right away. God. And she was like, what's the point? And I was like, exactly. So they should have done old Gossip Girl and we don't know who it is until the end instead of new Gossip Girl where we knew it. That's my
I understand that these guys are artistic geniuses and they've been doing it for a while and they want things that excite them and kind of like you, right? Where you want the character, you want to get deep and you know, that's where you... But
that's my favorite.
Had we done a Birth of the FBI, I think that movie would have been so badass. Again... It wouldn't have been what the Osage maybe yeah. would have wanted. Although I've seen some pretty like some considerable critiques by writers or I guess the guy that helped with the translations on the film. It's like, what are we doing here? We're celebrating these evil men. We're spending 3 hours with just like these depraved idiots as opposed to I don't know. I don't know what people want, honestly, at yeah. this point. But you know, you don't want the FBI to come in as a white savior, old complex. You don't want to show. I guess maybe he just wasn't buying the fact that there was a love story there. Maybe that was the critique, and I can kind of see that where it's like, give me a break. We're supposed to believe that this woman is sticking by the guy murdering her and her family. It's tough. I mean, but it happened. So it's hard to get around that.
Yeah, but I did like that was another nice scene where they've got that close up and it's the interrogation, or not the interrogation, but the testimony and Lithgow is asking him all those like brutal questions and he's, yes sir, yes sir, yes mm-hmm. sir, yes sir, and you watch his face change as the difficulty of him admitting those truths and then they ask the question about his wife and he's like, no, I've always loved yeah. my wife and it you can just tell in the performance that that's an honest answer and it's sad because he. Obviously listened to and took the advice of a very
evil man
a manipulative person and so yeah it's that's tragic in its own way.
Yeah, I mean he's not completely faultless, right? Because we see him like I love money, I just love money, and he's like
he loves money more than her.
Yeah, what sucks is that when this comes out on Apple Plus, people are going to, like, fire this up in, like, 3 segments and then, like bail on it after watching an hour. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I think The Irishman, as loath I am to admit it, you could break that up into kind of 3 eras, kind of, like, do it 1 hour at a time, and it's not terrible. I had a great time watching that movie start to finish in a theater, The Irishman, but... this one, I feel like it's the sum of all of its parts. It's and maybe, you know, you kind of lose steam, but it is the build as opposed to if you break it up, I think you lose the momentum and the sense of foreboding, I guess. It's, yeah. it's a, anyway. a delicate balance.
I agree. I agree. But overall, I guess if I had to do a summary as they do on Rotten Tomatoes, it's always a pleasure to see an artist like that working his craft, even if it's not my favorite. I think, obviously, narratively, I would have liked a little more energy to it. I would have liked a stronger pace. But I think performance-wise, all of them were great. And I think overall, there'll be some lasting memories, but I haven't thought about it nearly as much as I've thought about other Scorsese movies post-watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is maybe, I think you could still consider this top 10 Scorsese, maybe, or it's probably second tier, maybe around like the Casino level.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this will raise an estimation. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. I don't necessarily think the people will be heading in droves and
I'd be
dropping
really
to their knees.
Yeah. I coach a lot of people in their early to mid 20s, and I'd be really surprised if any of them came in charged up being like, I just saw Killers of the Flower Moon and I am floored. Like, it's not gonna, this is definitely for the older or just kind of a more refined cinematic palette.
I saw an interesting stat though. 45% of moviegoers that bought a ticket to Flower or Killers were under 35 years old.
That's a win.
45%.
I hope they enjoyed it. We need them to come back.
Yeah, well, it's like Taylor Swift fans going to the Chiefs game. They don't really know what they're doing there. they're just like, old people aren't here anymore.
How many of those people accidentally thought they were buying a ticket to the Eras Tour, and it was sold out, so they ended up in the wrong theater?
100%. I love the thing where it's like, Taylor Swift is checking in on all of her stadiums before they become Mojo Dojo Casa houses for the NFL
stadium. There you go. I like that.
All right, we're bringing it back around. This is actually Swift pod.
Bookend. Well, thank you guys for listening, and thank you guys for enjoying some of our Killers of the Flower Moon talk in between our Taylor Swift talk. So.
Well, we still got 3 hours to go on Killers, Bob. I mean, we're only 40 minutes into the pod.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's
a lot of fun,
everybody.
Well, in a brief intermission, we'll come back. We'll do a deep dive on Brendan Fraser and his career going forward. God. Yeah, well, check it out. I think I liked it more than I initially did when I came out of the theater. I think I'll go see it again with my girlfriend Jordan. And
there you go.
And I'll report back on a second viewing. But I think I'm with you initially on being disappointed. But I think it might, there's redeemable qualities. Yeah,
it's coming. It's growing. It's growing like those flowers on the hill under the moon called the Flower Moon.
The Flower Moons.
There you go.
Cool, man.
Well, thank you guys all for hanging with us and watching a 3.5-hour movie and listening to a 45-minute podcast on it. We would love if you smash that subscribe button. Leave us some comments if you guys enjoyed what you heard. We'll see you guys next time, and we will see you
down the road.
Down the road.
Listen for a while.
Bye.
Start giving names. They called him the king of the Osage Hills. He went and got everybody killed. Now they talk about the weather like it's judgment coming soon. Oh, the killers of the Flower Moon.